You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in studio by producer Samantha. Coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the party's annual rally that happened yesterday and the choice of US author James Lindsay as a keynote speaker, as well as the recent public hearings into the Royal Commission of Inquiry into the former government's COVID-19 response. Following up with my chat with Simon Court, I spoke to the Pōneke Anti-Fascist Coalition's Anne Campbell about James Lindsay and his controversial views. I spoke to Dr. Colin Bjork, a senior communications lecturer at Massey University, about the government's recently released AI strategy. And I spoke to AI and technology governor, Dr. Karaitiana Tairu, about how the government's AI strategy coexists with Te Ao Māori. Samantha, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Professor of Geology at University of Auckland, Phil Shane, about the sustainability issues with modern society in the global north.
Here are Hō Whakaaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or Waimai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware e ahei ana koto te whakaronga ki e nei, korero ano hei pakihiri rokiroki mārunga I te pai tukutuku o Irirangi Pōhō, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Yesterday, the ACT Party held their annual rally called the Free and Equal Rally. Notably, US author James Lindsay was a keynote speaker at the event. Lindsay is the author of Cynical Theories, How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender and Identity, and Why This Harms Everybody, among other titles such as Race and Marxism, The Truth About Critical Race Theory and Praxis, and The Queering of the American Child, How a New School Religious Cult Poisons the Mind and Bodies of Normal Kids. Party leader David Seymour says Lindsay is a prominent advocate for free speech. Prior to the event, a spokesperson for the party said Lindsay would discuss reclaiming liberalism in an age of extremes. For our weekly catch-up, I spoke to the ACT Party's Simon Court about the rally, why the party chose Lindsay as a keynote speaker, and we addressed some of the concerns with Lindsay's previous comments. We also discussed the first public hearings into the Royal Commission of Inquiry into the former government's COVID-19 response, and what to expect heading into the next hearings in Wellington next month. But first, we discussed ACT's 2025 Free and Equal Rally. How was the 2025 ACT Party Rally?
Look, it was fantastic. We had almost 500 paying guests come to hear updates from ACT ministers, Brooke Van Velden, about what she's doing around the labour laws, from Nicole McKee about cracking down on crime and cutting the red tape around the anti-money laundering laws that make it really complicated to transact property, and from Karen Chua about what she's doing to promote the care and protection of young people. And I had an opportunity as Undersecretary for Resource Management Reform to talk about the work we're doing, the progress we've made in kind of panel beating the RMA, you know, that lemon that we're stuck with for a little bit longer, and what we're going to do when we introduce legislation later this year to create a separate planning act for planning and development and a separate natural environment act so we can actually focus on and protect the environmental values that Kiwis all agree that we want to protect.
At this year's rally or AGM, the party invited US author James Lindsay as a keynote speaker. Why choose Lindsay for this role?
Well, Lindsay's speech was fantastic. It was about reclaiming this concept of classical liberalism in an age of extremes. He spoke about why liberalism is actually the best way of ensuring that, you know, we can flourish, we can create wealth and solve our problems. And he also warned about the dangers of judging people and treating them differently based on their background rather than what they do and say. And, you know, James is one of those people who really shines a bright light on what is good and what is possible, and what are some of the dangers lurking out there around, you know, what's happening in academia in terms of, you know, cancel culture and shutting down debate and this concept of settled science. It was really, really good to hear his perspective from the US.
Lindsay has a history of making conspiratorial and controversial statements, such as referring to the LGBTQIA plus community as groomers, calling the pride flag the flag of the hostile enemy, has said there will be a white genocide if critical race theory isn't stopped, has pushed the cultural Marxism theory, among other things. How does the ACT Party feel about platforming conspiracy theorists?
Well, we're tired of this cancel culture and the kind of ideological purity tests that people on the left try to apply to others. You don't have to agree on everything that someone says to find value in listening to them. And what was really interesting about what James Lindsay said was that societies progress best when people are able to trade value for value, not to see the world as a zero-sum game where what I get is because somebody else has lost something, that actually if we approach problems as individuals with, you know, all of our innovation, all of our ideas, we can solve them together and then go our separate ways, having taken more value away from that interaction than simply trying to say, well, can the state take something from them to make me better? That's not going to work anywhere in the world. It's certainly not going to work in New Zealand. And James Lindsay was really helpful in pointing out some examples to illustrate that.
Does the ACT Party align with Lindsay's views regarding the LGBTQI plus community, critical race theory, and all his aforementioned statements?
James Lindsay is free to hold his own views. The ACT Party has very clear values, and we are a classically liberal party. We support the rights of individuals to express themselves. And we got a lot of benefit from hearing James Lindsay speak about, you know, the things that we have in common.
Are the ACT Party willing to scrutinise any of these comments?
Well, as I pointed out, we don't see the need to conduct ideological purity tests on everybody that we meet with or everybody that we interact with. We don't need to think about, well, is this person pure enough or should we cancel them? And we're not worried about that. We just want to understand what individuals can contribute. What do they bring? Rather than judge them by things that they might have said in the past or things they didn't get quite right.
Are these the type of views we need in Aotearoa?
Well, again, you're trying to get me to apply an ideological purity test. And maybe Lindsay had a point where he said this kind of cancel culture, this cultural Marxism, where, you know, if you don't pass the purity test, you're going to end up in some kind of social gulag. Maybe that's not a good idea. Maybe what we should be doing instead, and I agree with Lindsay on this, is let's listen to individuals bringing their ideas about how to solve society's problems, whether it's about, you know, how do we make housing more affordable, how do we generate cleaner, more affordable energy. These are all real problems to solve. And, you know, you don't need to conduct a purity test on what somebody said once or what they posted on social media to work out if they've got something positive to contribute.
On to our next topic. Auckland has recently wrapped up its first public hearings into the Royal Commission of Inquiry into the government's COVID-19 response. Why are we seeing the second inquiry?
Well, the previous Labor government had very narrow terms for phase one of the inquiry, and they ignored the real pain of lockdowns. They ignored the effects and consequences of imposing vaccine mandates on workforces like police and nursing and defence and education. And they ignored the effects of shuttering businesses that sent people broke and shattered their mental health. And so what ACT said right through the previous government's pandemic response was you need to consider these things as well as the impacts on health from COVID. Labor wouldn't. So that's why we have extended the Royal Commission of Inquiry to look into those really important matters.
This inquiry was a coalition agreement between ACT and New Zealand First. However, opposition leader Chris Hipkins says references of New Zealand First in government during the start of the pandemic being excluded is somewhat unusual. Why has this been excluded?
Well, I'm not aware that things that the that New Zealand first talked about are excluded. We're just looking into all of the decisions that were taken that affected schools, businesses, social cohesion, the collateral damage on mental health. We want to find out exactly what happened, what decisions were taken that led to certain outcomes. Because one thing I know from my time working in emergency management and disaster response when I worked at Auckland Council is that pandemics are one of the top five natural disasters we need to prepare for, along with, you know, cyclones and various things. So we can expect it to happen again. We need to learn so we don't end up with like a Chinese Communist Party response, locking people in their homes, locking the borders and telling people that they couldn't go and spend time with loved ones who are dying. And we can't do that again.
Internal Affairs Minister Brooke Van Velden says expanding the inquiry was to cover outstanding matters of public concern. However, those with long COVID feel as though they have been left out. Long COVID Support Aotearoa spokesperson Catherine Appleby says the inquiry not addressing those with post-COVID conditions is a massive mistake, as those with these conditions were and still are directly affected. Are there plans to address long COVID in next month's inquiry in Wellington?
Look, I'm not entirely sure whether long COVID is in fact excluded. And I guess what you're talking about is people who experience a COVID-19, contracted the illness and still have ongoing symptoms or, you know, haven't fully recovered. That's clearly a really important medical issue. I'm sure that the effects of the COVID-19 virus, yeah, and what it actually did to people in terms of impacts on their health and well-being will certainly be taken into account. What we're trying to find out is this balance. Of course, it was important to protect people from contracting the virus, to protect people who are most vulnerable, whether they were the elderly or had other underlying conditions. But, you know, I think what New Zealanders could all agree on is that the controls had far too much collateral damage. I mean, locking down Auckland for 4 months for one case and then continuing the lockdowns, continuing to run MIQ while there were 15, 20, 30,000 cases in the community, none of those things made sense at the time to me sitting in Auckland lockdown. And they certainly need to be looked into.
Speaking to next month's public hearings in Wellington, how different do you think the public hearings will be there as opposed to up here in Auckland?
Well, you know, it is a Royal Commission, which is the highest level of inquiry, and we expect people to bring their best evidence and to participate in a respectful and interested way, because, you know, we want to understand what happened, what decisions were taken by decision makers. You know, that is why the government, that is why the Royal Commission is proposing to invite decision makers, people like Hipkins, people like Prime Minister, former Prime Minister Ardern, who were in government. And we hope they turn up. I mean, they would be required to if they're in the country. And this is the effect of a legal summons. These people who claim that they ran the best COVID response ever, they should front up and explain that, you know, maybe some of their decisions had collateral damage. Did they consider that? And if so, you know, what was front of mind when they made those decisions? We need to know, because we expect something like this to happen again. We need to be better prepared.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on the party's recent rally, the party's choice of having author James Lindsay speak, and the first public hearings into the prior government's COVID-19 response.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
The government has indicated The Wire.
Following up on my chat with Simon Court, I spoke with the Pōneke Anti-Fascist Coalition's Anne Campbell. The ACT Party's choice of James Lindsay as a keynote speaker has raised concerns about a spread of conspiracy theories and thoughts on minority communities, such as the LGBTQI+ community. I spoke to Campbell about James Lindsay, his controversial comments, and what this means for Aotearoa. Who is James Lindsay?
So he made his name originally by doing something called the Grievance Affair, I think. It was submitting a lot of fake papers to academic journals and trying to sort of catch them out as gotcha things about academic publishing standards. And I can't quite remember how it happened, but from there he sort of spiraled into becoming this sort of far-right commentator.
This is not the first time Lindsay has come to the country. In March, Lindsay headed a free speech union tour in Aotearoa. What sort of things did we see from him on this tour?
I'm not actually sure about that tour, but to be honest, the research we've done on him, he seems to be quite obsessive about sort of anti-queer stuff, very offended at the idea that people might care about racism and things like that. a lot of what he says really seems to be the same kind of bog-standard stuff that a lot of right-wing people say. Like, you look through his views and it's like, oh, yep, here's the racism, here's the transphobia, here's the opposition to, you know, cultural Marxism or whatever. It's just very, very routine for these people. They all seem to have the same kind of neuroses. It's very tiresome.
What is Lindsay's relationship with the ACT Party and specifically the party's leader, David Seymour?
They seem to be, you know, just regard each other as sort of colleagues and, co-conspirators and these kind of things. Seymour talked of him as a kind of pleasant, intelligent person to work with over the weekend. I'm not sure of their exact professional relationship.
You briefly touched on this, but Lindsay is a conspiracy theorist and has made some extremely controversial statements. He has correlated the LGBTQI plus community to being groomers, has referred to the pride flag as the flag of the hostile enemy, has said there will be a white genocide if critical race theory is not stopped, has mocked the death of George Floyd, has pushed the conspiracy theory of cultural Marxism, among other things. What impacts have we seen from these conspiracy theories to those they target, such as the rainbow community?
Yeah, we just see like really ramped up hostility at a population-wide level in the States. A lot of these conspiracies have been used to restrict trans healthcare. And yeah, it's kind of this form of stochastic terrorism. Like, public figures like Lindsay or maybe like Seymour will sort of say, oh, these minorities are really bad, they're out to get your kids, be careful, make sure you be careful. And it kind of, maybe they don't carry out the violence themselves directly, but it encourages people in the population to take up that violence. So and it just creates a generally hostile atmosphere for these minorities, and you know, acknowledge that a lot of society is against them, which is obviously really demoralizing.
What impacts could these comments have long term?
Yeah, in New Zealand, it could increase the likelihood of this government being inclined to pass, the anti-queer, anti-trans legislation that they've already been trying to introduce. And it just kind of, poisons the well of political discourse, makes certain things more acceptable for people to say publicly. Because, a lot of these people sort of posit themselves as just asking questions, but the underlying question that they're asking is, you know, do queer people deserve to live? Do black people deserve to live? And, you know, our side answers like, well, yes. And they're like, yeah, but do they really, though? It's just this kind of, that it destroys any reasonable debate and just keeps it at this kind of, really substandard level that questions the humanity of particular minorities. But yeah, it's just the kind of detached commitment to this form of right-wing stuff that is quite, I think, strange to most people. Like, we have a level of systemic racism and transphobia in this country that encourages certain attitudes, but I think most people don't really have that strong opinions on it either way, and find these kind of fixations that the right wing have in their, you know, obsession with, I don't know, calling the queer flag the flag of a hostile enemy. I think most people are like, oh, really? But, you know, why is this such a big problem for you? And, you know, I think most people would hear statements by people like James Lindsay, what do you say something about, you know, keep calling, you know, people who believe in justice for George Floyd, they'll get presents delivered to them, you know, like Santa. Like, that's very strange kind of stuff. And I think people like Seymour, either don't realize how completely out of touch this makes them, or do realize and are just like, I'm just going to try to drag the rest of the country along with me. But yeah, it's very gross.
What were ACT's motives to have Lindsay as a keynote speaker at this year's rally?
So they talked about having him, you know, as a advocate of free speech and, you know, asking questions and broadening debates and stuff like that. I think the motivation is just to, increase kind of support for these really fringe views. A lot of these right-wing figures have these kind of skeletons in their closet, often at a personal level, that they seem to be trying to, you know, surround themselves with other people who help them deal with that. While we were researching this stuff, I actually found this article showed James Lindsay was trying to suppress this photo he'd taken of him and this woman, Nikki Klein, who was part of the Nixium cults, which is a sort of multi-level marketing thing that turned into a very, you know, sexually abusive cult, basically. And, you know, people would repost the stuff and James Lindsay was like, please take it down. These are all like weird people who just need to surround themselves with other weird people to make themselves feel less gross.
You've briefly touched on this throughout the interview, but what does this say, what does the choice of James Lindsay as a keynote speaker say about the ACT Party heading forward?
Yeah, I guess that they're just really committed to overtly hostile racism and transphobia and things like that. when Seymour was told about Lindsay's views on the queer community, he was like, oh yeah, well, I don't have those myself, but I don't mind. So I think they just want to drag people into these kind of ideas, basically.
That was the Pornicare Anti-Fascist Coalition's Anne Campbell on the ACT Party's choice of having controversial US author James Lindsay as a keynote speaker at their most recent rally.
Oh yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text in on 5395 any of your thoughts on these pieces.
On Wednesday night, you've climbed the mountain of the week and reached the top, but before you roll down the hill, you get a reward. No, it's not the view. This is radio. No, you don't get to meet an all-powerful being. This is an alternative radio station. At the top of the mountain, you get the top 10 songs of the week on 95BFM. Brought to you by the Mountain Guardians, Sam and Jack.
The 95BFM Top 10. The toppest top tracks of the week. 7 to 8pm every Wednesday. Vote online at 95bfm.com/vote.
You're listening to Talking Tracks on PBNZ.
And as I said, Frith, if this harpsichord is gauche, then what's Max Martin? Seriously though, a crisp and ebullient debut from this young artist. Mm. And now from our new contributor, Daryl.
Yeah, mate.
Are you trying to humiliate me?
No.
Is this funny to you? Screeching uncultured no-fi bullshit? Get out!
Real pain for sham friends. Dirtbag Radio for real friends.
'Cause I wanna go out and get drunk and dance.
Dirtbag Radio. Mondays, 7 to 9pm with Rapley. Thanks to Go Cooler Music, Auckland's newest secondhand music store at 370A Broadway Newmarket. Only on 95BFM.
Oh,
Welcome back. That was Cardboard Boat by Orking. You're tuned in to The Wire on 95 BFM.
What's his title? The guy in charge, Dr. Ashley Broom?
The Director General of Health.
Yeah.
The Wire.
As the climate and sustainability crisis continues to worsen and corporations and governments refuse to act, the question must be asked, do we need to rethink our entire society? From one built on resource extraction for profit to one built around sustainable local living. I spoke to Professor of Population Health at the University of Auckland, Phil Shane, about the sustainability of our society. Why are governments and industries so non-receptive to change?
I think we have to look back over all of human history. Most of us are only concerned with sort of our immediate surroundings and our immediate future and the people we know. So we sort of just naturally, it's not sinister, we just naturally discount people we don't know and faraway places and the uncertain future. So put simply, we really want business as usual, but by alternative means if we can improve things. Bottom line, we only think short term.
Given that fossil fuels are used in the production of renewable energies, for example, the steel used to make windmills, can we do anything to make fossil fuels entirely obsolete?
I think the only way to have fossil fuels entirely obsolete would be a complete civilization change. But keep in mind that that doesn't have to be as bad as it sounds. We seem to be more concerned about losing civilization rather than losing the planet. So if we want to do away with fossil fuels, which you need to remember are linked to making things like fertilizer and steel and concrete, we need to go to a lifestyle that's based more on localized living, interacting with nature, things like regenerative agriculture. You need to remember, we did live like that for tens of thousands of years. It's only in the last 150 years or so that we've changed to this alternative world where we need endless energy.
Well, a follow-up question I'd like to ask is, how can that kind of living support the 8 billion people that we have in the world now?
Well, we have to remember that fossil fuel and our various ideologies and narratives that we've just basically made up and are not based on biophysical reality has led to an overshoot in the population that can be sustained by the planet. So we have to accept that is an issue. But in saying that, we have to remember that a lot of poverty is created by people being moved off their land, being forced to live in the city, and meaning that they just, even people with skills, don't have access to land where they could grow their own food and live. So we have to remember, even if we chose globally to move to a lifestyle that was more localized and based on regenerative agriculture, that could actually be better than the system we've got now for a lot of people that live in relative poverty. There isn't, I'm not saying there's any simple solutions. I don't know how it would play out. All I know is even now, there are a lot of people who possibly would have a better diet and access to clean water if they had access to land. And to do that, we'd have to move away from cash crops and manufacturing.
Currently, there is a debate over the future of transportation. With EVs becoming more prominent as a choice of vehicle, given how dangerous and energy-consuming it is to mine the lithium used for their batteries, is public transportation the answer?
Yes. In the long run, public transportation is the answer. But if you think even more broadly, cities have become too large. We're living too far away from where our water and food resources come from. So although public transport would be a step in the right direction, the direction to go would be more localized living. Cities are just sort of like a large parasite on Earth, drawing on all the surrounding landscape. We need to spread out and work and live within nature if possible. But yes, EVs don't solve anything. Electrical vehicles are only an alternative means to keeping the same sort of lifestyle we've got now. But the lifestyle we've got now cannot continue because Earth is finite.
There is a common assumption that it is an individual responsibility for citizens to lower their carbon footprint. However, the biggest polluters are corporations. So what can we really do about it as citizens?
As individuals, it's very difficult to do anything. As we've seen in any global issues, not just environmental ones, civil rights, anything, it's hard for an individual to have much of an impact. We can only achieve something if we work collectively. If we form localized groups of like-minded people, in the long run, if we were happy to give up 24-hour ice cream and didn't need TikTok, and didn't feel pressure to have children that then require plastic toys, and there's a whole educational industry associated with that, we would find that collectively some businesses would slowly fade out and collapse if we stopped consuming what they produce.
The current coalition government has reversed several environmental regulations from the previous government. What impacts will this have heading forward?
New Zealand is a small country, and it seems like every time we have a change of government, we have a complete change of policy. So it's difficult to know if we're going in any direction or achieving anything. But as a small country with land that can produce water and food, we would have the potential to go in a completely different direction. I don't like to make it political, though. Right and left is just identity politics. Both are just trying to achieve the same thing, but by different means. We have to think more widely than current politics. But extraction of resources, rapid use of them, only means we're going to just leave an IOU to all young people as we use up all the resources for ourselves.
Overall, what needs to change when discussing sustainability heading forward?
My personal view of sustainability is it's become a buzzword. Everything is sustainable. Everybody wants to be sustainable. But the planet can't sustain a human population that is already in overshoot. Overshoot means we're living beyond the carrying capacity of the planet. Humans are. We have been in this state for decades. So sustainability, I think, is the wrong concept. We actually need to work towards reduction. There are some political movements like degrowth, but we need a broader conversation. Everybody needs to be on board with the general goal of let's reduce the energy and materials we use and create a new relationship with nature. Because when you think about it, once we've got the basic things we need, like shelter and food, all the best things in life are free anyway. So it's an actual mindset change that we need. And sustainability, the risk of using that term too much is that it implies we can keep living the same way, which we can't.
How long do we have to make fundamental change?
Nobody has a crystal ball. If someone tells you they've got a solution or they know the future, you probably can stop listening to them. All we can really say is that We know for decades, mostly because of the global north or rich countries, that we've been extracting too much and using too much energy. There are some good systems models, like the limits to growth done by an MIT group more than 50 years ago and updated regularly. But some systems models have suggested that we really need to make a major global change within 100 years, which started back in about the early 1970s. So I just, no one can predict the future, but if we just care about other life and young people, we want to really just start making the changes right now. We're already 50 years too late.
When you say that we've gone past the carrying capacity of the planet, is that in terms of resource extraction or is that in terms of the number of people?
The concept of going beyond the carrying capacity of the planet is very much from the work of William Rees and the ecological footprint, which is well established and strongly supported by global data. What it actually means is if we looked at all of the area available to humans to get the water and food and fibers they need, and also to assimilate all of the waste, then at the moment we're using more area on Earth than there is available. So we're using something like 1.7 Earths, even though we've only got one Earth. So how do we use more than one planet when there is only one planet? It's because there are living resources like fish stocks, and there's non-living resources like metals and coal. And what we're doing is rather than using them at a slow rate, the living things can renew. The inorganic things like coal or metal can't renew. But for the living things that can renew, which we depend on our food and we can use wood to build houses, we're extracting them at a rate greater than they can renew. So all we're doing is we've got living and non-living resources and we're drawing them down quicker than they could ever come back. Think of it like money in the bank. Rather than living on the interest from the money you from your deposit in the bank, you're drawing down the deposit itself. So it's sort of like spending all your savings to go on holiday, and then after your holiday, you have nothing left.
That was Professor of Population Health Phil Shane from the University of Auckland on the sustainability of our society and where we should go next.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
We've been right.
That song is Rain Day Out by Blunt Dog. And before that, you had Tunnels by Office Dog. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM.
You know, our call is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay. It's BFM.
The Wire.
Recently, Science and Technology Minister Shane Retty announced New Zealand's first ever artificial intelligence, or AI, strategy. With this, Aotearoa becomes the last country in the OECD to establish guidelines around the use of AI. Despite the establishment of this strategy, which is aimed at enticing the private sector to incorporate and invest in AI, there are concerns that the strategy does not introduce any new legislation to regulate AI, rather using already existing legislation, and also fails to address ethical concerns. I spoke to Dr. Colin Bjork, a senior communications lecturer at Massey University, about the strategy document and how much of an impact the strategy will have on the private sector to be better engaged with AI usage. What is the purpose of having an AI strategy?
The purpose, and a number of countries are beginning to do this now, New Zealand's actually a little bit behind on this, is to have kind of a coordinated national approach to both investing in and regulating artificial intelligence technologies and the companies that are producing and using and selling those.
You are correct in saying that New Zealand is behind on implementing these sort of guidelines. We are the last country to have implemented an AI strategy in the OECD. Why have we seen this delay?
That's a good question. I think New Zealand has been a little bit behind in regulating social media, for example, and thinking of a coordinated approach to the large big tech companies that Europe has already kind of created an approach there. But New Zealand's been behind. So I think we've been a little bit behind, or maybe a lot of behind, depending on how fast you expect governments to move, just historically in terms of ability to kind of step in and imagine how to regulate technology and find a way forward with technology in our country. So there's a historical issue to it. I think also this government is kind of against regulation full stop. So I think there's the current government also has kind of perspective on regulation that's led to some of those delays, I suppose.
How does our guidelines for AI use compare to other countries?
So That's a good question. I haven't explicitly read the documents from other countries' AI guidelines, but I have seen some reporting on AI guidelines in other countries. And I would say one of the things that stands out to me about ours, this New Zealand document, is that it doesn't explicitly put into play any new policies, regulations, and not really any new investments. The government sort of points to like existing policies, existing laws, and existing investments that this particular new government has already put into play. So whereas other countries are actually thinking about ways to step in and say, okay, where do we want our data centers? What are the environmental regulations we want to have around the energy usage of these AI companies and the safety issues around it? This seems to be a full-throated support for AI technology without a lot of specificity around how they want that to look for our country.
The guidelines emphasize the economical positives for the private sector in engaging with AI. Have ethical implications, such as the impact AI is having on the climate crisis and the potential for AI to take away jobs from people, have these concerns been adequately engaged with within the strategy?
That's an excellent question. So you're absolutely right that the AI policy foregrounds the economics, right? And I think it's quite interesting that the AI policy cites for evidence of the economic, you know, windfall that AI is likely to send our direction. They cite, documents from Microsoft itself. And of course, Microsoft has a vested interest in us, you know, buying into the AI hype because Microsoft is closely linked to OpenAI and Microsoft is building lots of new data centers, which will power these AI machines, right? So the economic, I think there are probably economic benefits, but we need to be very careful about who we take as the authoritative sources on how big those economic benefits are. As terms of the ethics and questions that you raised in terms of the climate risk and jobs risks, I don't think that the current AI policy sufficiently engages those topics. It sort of says, oh, we've already got existing laws on the books that regulate, you know, businesses and industries to protect the climate, and we've already got jobs, or we've already got, you know, laws on the books that protect workers. But I think that those existing laws have holes in them, right? Like, we look at how a lot of these, the large AI mainstream Silicon Valley systems, these AI systems are built on the intellectual property of others, right? On creators, on artists, on writers, on authors. And yet, when we have legislation about intellectual property rights and copyright, and yet that legislation does, you know, has not been put into play with these AI companies yet, right? So there's a gap in the existing legislation that I think that needs to, that the government, if it wants to have a national policy on AI, needs to better address the existing gaps in our legislation rather than assuming that the current stuff works just fine for AI, because it doesn't.
A barrier the document discusses is regulatory uncertainty and how many businesses are uncertain on how existing laws interact with the application of AI. Does this document clarify these uncertainties enough to guarantee businesses are well-informed and comfortable to implement AI?
The short answer is no. It doesn't. What it does is the document gives its full-throated support for AI, which implies that if you build a company around AI and you're engaged in some kind of use right now, that you won't end up facing, you know, financial regulatory consequences down the road. But I think that's the implication, right? And they're saying, don't worry about it, just go for it. They're, you move fast and break things, right? That Silicon Valley mantra is sort of what the government is hinting at for the business sector. But like, without an actual policy in place, for when clear agenda for like, well, we want to regulate in these ways, but not in these other ways, the companies actually can't be certain that when after the next election, whichever new government comes in might not have a different approach, right? And if you only go on what's implied, and I think you're going to, businesses can still be cautious, right? Because an AI investment is a long-term investment for it to pay out, and you want to be certain as a business owner that it will pay out for you.
New Zealand is an adherent to the OECD AI values-based principles. One of these is human rights and democratic values, including fairness and privacy. Last week, we saw Elon Musk's Grok chatbot share anti-Semitic comments as it was relying too much on user input. If we are at the whim of overseas AI developers, how can the private sector, specifically small and medium enterprises or SMEs with smaller capacities, align with these principles?
Yeah, so that's a big and important question. And you mentioned a couple of things, right? The OECD values, human rights, democracy, privacy, and the challenge that it is to thread that needle with these overseas companies, and like Grok, which is Elon Musk's AI, which was pretty horrifically anti-Semitic. So the answer is, I think the government in this policy proposes that we don't spend a lot of time developing AI in Aotearoa, New Zealand, but instead we think about applying AI in the business sector. That's sort of what they're suggesting in this policy. And I think actually reliance on overseas AI technologies, the big Silicon Valley ones, could, you know, down the road, end up becoming a tail wagging the dog situation, right? Where these massive companies and these massive billionaire owners could have an outsized, as you mentioned, our democracy, our privacy, our human rights. I think actually there is something to be said for developing Aotearoa-based AI. You won't be able to do it at scale of these Silicon Valley companies that have these massive data sets that they can use as training data to work on the AI. But we already have excellent examples in this country of homegrown AI. Tehiku Media in the Northland is a Maori-owned media company that created and that crowdsourced an AI transcription tool. So you can go from speech to text in the Maori language, right? So we have original homegrown cases that I think are worth investing in that can help us achieve those goals of the values that are important to us, to our democracy, to indigenous data sovereignty, and help us kind of keep at quite a distance the dangers of the things that we saw in Grok this past week.
You've briefly touched on this throughout our chat, but overall, is this strategy enough to entice the private sector to adopt AI or even invest in it in Aotearoa?
No, I don't think it is. It needs to be, we need more clarity from the government on how specifically to invest, how to invest wisely, safely, and that'll be, we have different answers in different sectors, right? It'll be different in medicine than it will be in construction, right? And we need clarity around, we need regulation. We absolutely need it, and we need to figure out what that looks like. And that needs to be the urgent kind of direction, in my perspective, for our country.
I also spoke to AI and Technology Governor Dr. Karaitiana Tairu about how Te Ao Māori is engaged within this strategy and whether more needs to be done in this capacity. How does this strategy cooperate with iwi Māori?
Yes, it doesn't directly reference or appeal to iwi Māori, but it is written on the premises of using the OECD principle. So amongst those international principles are an obligation to consider human rights and to consult with all of the community. So indirectly, yeah, we will have representation and acknowledgement through the international, those international principles. It's not ideal. It's very indirect, as I said, but at least it's kind of, we've got a little pathway there. The other thing to point out too is, the AI strategy is very high level and doesn't really say much. And it has been widely criticised for not actually doing too much. So again, I think because of that high level attitude that's been taken, I think iwi and Māori will have to rely heavily on the OECD principles.
Is Te Tiriti o Waitangi referenced in this strategy at all?
No, not directly, no. It's only referenced in the guidance from government to small businesses.
Stats New Zealand have an agreement called the Mana Ōrite Relationship Agreement with the Data Iwi Leaders Group of the National Iwi Chairs Forum to ensure data collection will create positive outcomes for iwi Māori. Are we seeing something similar with the government strategy for using AI in the country?
No. What we've seen is the government have provided a very high-level strategy and basically said that we don't want to regulate. It's up to communities to do that themselves. So that is a bit of an issue. But research from the AI Forum, Aotearoa's AI Forum, showed that over 50% of companies in New Zealand voluntarily choose to engage some form of digitality process with their AI. So, to me, that's encouraging. And if the government paying for commercial services from those companies, then we'll see some sort of reflection of digitality and Te Ao Māori that way.
You have mentioned some of the criticisms, or people have criticised the strategy document. The strategy document has ruled out new legislation, rather going about AI usage with a light touch and principle-based approach for already existing regulations. Should we be seeing clear legislation here?
Ideally, we will see more regulation / legislation. There's the whole human rights aspect has been left out. Workers' rights is a classic example. We know AI will disrupt many current jobs in New Zealand. The strategy doesn't provide any sort of protection for them. There's all the other communities who are going to be impacted without clear guidelines. This includes the disabled communities, Pacifica, immigrants, LGBTQ plus communities, all currently vulnerable without some form of regulation or legislation.
If most AI systems are designed overseas, maybe even with a Western worldview, how can tikanga be actively engaged regarding its usage here in Aotearoa?
So that's, that's up to New Zealanders to embrace and adopt local tikanga. And I'd like to think that we would also, good companies that we should be investing our money with will be promoting those values. They'll be promoting the Human Rights Act, the Bill of Rights Act, and genuinely respecting and protecting our diverse communities here in New Zealand. If we don't, we will just end up being what will continue to be consumers of American tech culture, which is very much about commercialization and ignoring human rights of minorities.
You've touched on this previously, but what sort of regulations would you like to see heading forward that are in the best interest of iwi Māori and other marginalized communities?
So I think copyright laws need to be addressed, bullying and harassment. So the Digital Harmful Communications Act needs a major rewrite because, as we know, already with technologies, minorities in particular, Indigenous females and people with disabilities are high on the target list of being bullied, so changing regulation there. The Crimes Act needs to be reviewed, intellectual property rights. There's a whole range of legislation. And I think the best way to address this would be having all New Zealand's legislation reviewed for impacts, possible impacts of AI and how best to address it.
That was Massey University's Dr. Colin Bjork and AI and Technology Governor Dr. Karaitiana Tairu about the government's recently released AI strategy.
When you see Paris Hilton carrying a chihuahua in a handbag, then suddenly there's going to be a certain segment of the New Zealand population that are suddenly going to want a chihuahua.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party Simon Court, Pōneke Anti-Fascist Coalition's Anne Campbell, the University of Auckland's Professor Phil Shane, Massey University's Dr. Colin Bjork, and AI and Technology Governor Dr. Karaitiana Tairu. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.